So let me begin by asking you this. How did it all start for you? What was your first encounter with Manchu like?
So in 2000, when I was doing my undergraduate in applied linguistics at Portland State University, I took some classes in classical Chinese and modern Chinese.
Mm-hmm. With Steve?
With Steve Wadley, right.
Yeah.
And one of my classmates dropped by my table when I was studying one day, and he said, "Do you want to join a secret class in Manchu?" And in my memory, he sort of opened up his jacket and showed me a copy of Roth Lee's textbook for
the green cover
two documents.
Right.
And I was like, "Of course, what is this secret class?" And so it turned out that Clancy, this student who dropped by my desk, had found out that Steve Wadley knew Manchu, and he'd gotten some students together and asked him if he would teach them Manchu. And the university wouldn't support it with any resources, so it had to be an after hours in empty classrooms sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a copy of Roth Lee's textbook and started coming to this class after hours and started learning Manchu.
And you were also doing this not for credit, right? A typical college student way of thinking.
Exactly. I got exactly one credit for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I got it because I was short one credit that I needed in order to get my degree. I was short exactly one credit that could be filled with a foreign language requirement. And so Steve had somehow gotten the class on the books for exactly one credit.
And that works. That's the one.
And that worked. Yeah,
so after graduation, you hang out in Portland, and this is when the Portland Manchu group formally started?
Yeah. So most of the members of the group weren't, in the end, students. Tom Larson was there. He was actually working at the library at Portland State University.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Keith Deedy joined when he moved down to Portland from Seattle. He'd been a student of Jerry Norman.
After he graduated, he happens to land in Portland.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a professor at Lewis and Clark College. And so and Yuki Kanai was a PhD student. So there were everybody who was in the class hung on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was living in town, and so I hung on as well. And I always made time to get out of whatever job I had and come down to PSU campus and take part in the classes as often as I could.
So still in the empty classroom, or was it in Steve's office?
Yep, it was. Mm-hmm. No, it was almost always in an empty classroom that we found in some building somewhere, whatever was unlocked.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't make a mess. So we hosted a conference on Manchu studies in 2004, and that was kind of an eye-opener for me.
Mm-hmm.
Into the sorts of things that a person could actually do with
Manchu.
Working with Manchu.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Elliott was there, and Hong Taek To and Jim Bossen.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of really, and Loretta Kim presented something.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of really interesting presentations that just sort of got me excited. And then Jerry Norman said, "Well, you should go get a PhD." And I thought, well, that sounds like a great idea. I don't know how to do that. But I started with a Regional Studies East Asia degree at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I did my homework and looked up your thesis.
Oh, you did?
Title, at least.
Uh-huh.
Did you know you wanted to work on Jagdan before you went there? Or?
Yes. And in the 2004 conference, Jim Bossen and Hong Taek To pulled out the stack of papers that were Jagdan's eighth fascicle.
Okay.
And I looked at that and I felt this extreme envy. there's poetry. It's not just everything we'd read, or almost everything we'd read had been translated from Chinese into Manchu in the group. And here was this original poetry in Manchu. Mm-hmm. And I at the time I thought, well, I can wait. They can translate it and then I'll buy the translation. But gosh, I'd really like to work on that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So that's what you ended up working on at Harvard.
Yeah.
But when you were in Cambridge, that was how the Portland Manchu Reading Group went online.
That's right. So, So initially what happened was that the original group continued to meet in person in empty classrooms at PSU.
Right.
And Keith Deedy brought a laptop. And so he would Skype me and I would join by Skype and we would communicate that way.
So if they meet in their evenings, it will be like your midnight.
Yep. Yep. Which was very convenient for my classes, yes. But maybe a little difficult for my sleep schedule.
So what did it ever break? Like this was 2005. Was the connection okay? Most of
Yeah, it was actually remarkably good. And eventually, I think it was probably in the wintertime because, you know, the winter becomes dark and cold in Portland. And all these people probably started thinking, well, why am I dragging myself to Portland State University campus in the dark and the rain when I could be joining online too? And so the whole thing moved online. And that led to sharing our texts electronically and a sea change in how we worked.
Mm-hmm. Professor Norman.
Right, because we were online, Jerry Norman could call in from Seattle.
Right.
So and in the old days, he'd come down every now and then and join our group in person. But now that we were online, he could join electronically.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really great. It was great to have his insights into things. We also, as soon as he joined, Tom and I had never studied any Mongolian, so we asked him to teach us Mongolian.
On Skype,
yeah. And so we bought all of our materials, and he found a number of bilingual or trilingual Manchu, Mongolian, and sometimes Chinese texts that we could study from.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what brought you up to Manzhou Shilu. Right.
Right. That's initially what led us to the Manzhou Shilu, is that it was it had a Mongolian text and a Manchu text.
Right.
And we started by reading the Mongolian because that's the language that we were learning at the time, and then comparing to the Manchu and the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Right. And a group of people who approach Manchu from a linguistic perspective, right, as opposed to a historical perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when we argue about things, we find ourselves arguing about matters of syntax or semantics or the nitty-gritty of the language.
I had a small discovery just reading the Wikipedia page for Jerry Norman, discovered he had a Princeton stint being a staff linguist at the Chinese Linguistic Project there.
I didn't know that.
Did he talk about that?
I don't remember him mentioning that. No, he didn't often talk about his career.
Mm-hmm.
Though sometimes I'd go up to Seattle and visit him, and he'd talk about different things that he'd done.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember him mentioning Princeton. Yeah.
Apparently, he met his wife there.
Okay,
that's just on the Wikipedia page, and I find amusing the Chinese Linguistic Project still exists today.
Oh yeah,
I might go ask my colleague someday.
That's wonderful.
But I think it says something to the transformation of this field, with the study of Manchu being in a linguistic philological register and a historical.
Yeah.
But then somehow we have this divergence of disciplinary approach. And then I think this is something that students today may not be aware, but that was a very different landscape back by then. And I think it's important to see your group as grown out of this context, right?
Yeah.
So it really touches me that the reading of Manzhou Shilu started, was it after you returned to Portland from Harvard?
Or? After Harvard, my wife and I moved to Washington, D.C., and that's where I was living when we started Manzhou Shilu.
I see. And then you eventually moved back.
Yeah, then we moved back to Portland.
Mm-hmm. You've been reading together for 20 years now?
Yes, as a group, we've been reading for 20 years.
So this project alone is over 10 years.
This project, I looked back, I believe it's, we've been working on this project for 8 years.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. And Professor Norman passed away in?
I thought it was 2014.
Okay. So you started from 2012.
Yeah.
And then you decided to continue.
Yeah.
After he passed away.
Yeah.
So where are you now?
So we've translated the entire Manzhou Shilu text that is our primary text.
Mm-hmm.
And we are now about 25% of the way through revising the translation. Our first round was a rough translation,
mm-hmm.
because the approach we took is a linguistics approach. We're focused on is getting the meaning, the syntax, and so forth, and answering all of those questions, making sure we had the right vocabulary. But on our second pass, we're going through and making it into something that a person could read without suffering mm-hmm. headaches.
For an English reader that may or may not know any Asian languages, but it will read nicely too. So can you describe how you worked online for the first go? So you have this trilingual text.
Right.
Manchu, Chinese, Mongolian. You're all on the screen. You're on Skype screen and you have a Google Doc.
Right.
Then what happens?
So we start out with creating a Google Doc that has two columns in it. One column is going to have the Manchu transliteration.
Mm-hmm.
The second column is going to have the English translation.
Right.
And we break it up into sections that end with finite verbs, because those are sort of the easiest things to translate as a small unit.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever has time works ahead and transliterates as much of the text as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we meet, there are two or three clearly defined roles.
Yeah.
There's a reader who reads from the Manchu text. And while that person is reading from the Manchu text, at least one person is checking the transcription.
Mm-hmm.
And at least another person is following along in the Manchu text to check for mistakes in the reading.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so once we've finished that process and made sure that the transliteration is good, the reader reads their translation
mm-hmm.
of the section. And another person acts as scribe and types out in the second column,
mm-hmm.
an English translation that represents what we land on.
Mm-hmm.
We very often argue over the initial translation. And so the scribe is sort of in charge of keeping track of our arguments and fixing things up and putting in notes and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And when we finish one block, we then move on to the next one.
So how do the Chinese version and Mongolian version chime in, because it sounds like you're principally working with the Manchu text.
Right. Since we stopped using Mongolian as our primary text, we went back and started with Manchu again.
Mm-hmm.
We've been principally using the Manchu text.
Yeah.
And we look at Chinese and Mongolian, particularly if we have questions,
mm-hmm.
Which we very often do.
Mm-hmm.
And we find in many cases that looking at the Chinese or Mongolian, we'll find sometimes an I-skip where a copyist seems to have skipped a line of text. And so that explains our difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Or we find that the Mongolian and Chinese translators were maybe as confused as we are because they've been very vague
mm-hmm.
about how they render the expression. Or sometimes they're as opaque as the Manchu.
Right.
there's a particular case where in the siege of the town of Gura, where Nikon Wailan is doing something.
He was the arch villain, right?
Yes, he's the arch villain, mm-hmm. right? And he's doing something so that the Ming troops know that he's not to be killed, so that the Ming troops know that he's on their side. Mm. But what he's doing, there's a verb that we couldn't find in any of our Manchu dictionaries. So we look at the Mongolian, and there's a verb there that we couldn't find in any of our Mongolian dictionaries. And we look at the Chinese, and the Chinese says that he's carrying I think the Chinese says he's carrying a white sash, uh-huh. but the Manchu verb looks like it ought to be a red sash or something like that. So there are cases like that where there's a difficulty across all three of the texts. Mm-hmm.
So you will need to settle on one version in English, marking that.
Yeah, and our approach has been to be extremely generous with footnotes initially, because it's easy to remove footnotes. If we decide that they're too much, mm-hmm. and so we've got lots of footnotes right now for these types of cases. We'll decide if the footnotes contribute to the readability or detract from it.
I guess this leads to the other question I had on mind the other day, which is that the Manzhou Shilu text is an artifact of history,
yes.
right? And you are working with the Qianlong period version?
Right. There are actually two types of Qianlong period versions of this text. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As you know, the Nurhaci Shilu texts start in 1636 or so with a text that was presented to Hong Taiji. Mm-hmm. And there were three translations, Manchu Chinese and Mongolian. Mm-hmm. And that text was modified, or it was revised by Dorgon and by the Shunzhe Emperor, mm-hmm. by Kangxi and Yongzheng and Qianlong.
And we have some scholarly discussion on the discrepancies that result from those moments.
Right, especially since the 1930s, there's been a lot of really, really interesting research of all of these differences. Mm-hmm. But in 1779, Qianlong says that he found an old copy of the Shilu text from the time when the Manchu dynasty was centered in Mukden. Mm-hmm. And he had copies of that text made. And so this essentially creates a branch in the tree. Mm. So there are two types of Qianlong texts. There's the one that is the revision of
both revisions.
Of the revisions. And then there's this other one that he says was very old, presumably the Hong Taiji text or not long after that. Mm. And that's the text that we're working with. The Prince's Study copy that Qianlong made. Mm-hmm. But we also have a bilingual Chongmo Pavilion edition, mm-hmm. and a trilingual Chongmo Pavilion edition, mm-hmm. For comparison. And Steve has done a lot of work looking at the differences between these three versions of this little branch off of the tree.
Right.
But what he finds is primarily that the differences are orthography and punctuation. Mm-hmm. The bilingual Chongmo edition uses a lot of old Manchu spelling conventions, mm-hmm. Like using a U bar after a front G in spelling the word gurun. Mm-hmm. That seems to lend weight to Qianlong's claim that he found this old version of the text and was simply making copies of it.
So it doesn't really add to the complexity in terms of content.
Right. It creates, it creates some interesting questions that I don't know if we'll ever be able to fully answer without knowing whether there really was an old Manchu text that Qianlong discovered. But it adds some interesting details that paleographic details, maybe. Mm-hmm. But there don't appear to be political revisions as far as we've been able to see.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of interest on those differences in the 1930s were driven by politics, right?
Yeah.
I think what doesn't get studied is not the high politics part, but how well do we know actually about this text?
Right. One of the practical difficulties I've run into is that taking the Manchu text as the primary text, it's easy, relatively speaking, to get hold of the other revisions of the Chinese text.
Mm.
It is more difficult to get hold of the other revisions of the Manchu text.
Mm.
And so that presents a practical difficulty to doing really long-range comparison that could really turn up some interesting political things throughout the years.
Yeah. I think logistically and humanly challenging for anyone to do it, him or herself. And also the kind of temporalities of academic life is such that we don't spend 10 years working on one text anymore. I mean, some of us still do, but I think this is something that goes against the logic of publishing things and getting funding and so on. So what really amazes me is that your work persisted not following the logic of academic work, but somehow besides it.
Yeah, I think that's largely attributable to the fact that it's not our primary, the primary work of anybody who's in the group.
Yeah.
That's something.
But then how many of us get to keep doing something after our work, right?
Exactly, yeah.
It's hard.
So in terms of audience, I think we're all agreed that what we would like is for a general audience, to have a better understanding of who the Manchus are and the place they hold in history, and Nurhaci in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows the name of Genghis Khan,
right?
And a lot of that, Steve thinks that a lot of that is because the secret history of the Mongols is available in a relatively easy to consume edition.
Mm-hmm.
That people can buy and read and learn about the early history of the Mongol Empire. And so we find that a lot of this text would be so engaging and interesting to a general audience that what we'd really like is to get it out there as a text for general consumption. On the other hand, we've got a lot of footnotes, and we've got right now a parallel Chinese and Manchu, or not Chinese and Manchu, a parallel English and Manchu text that could also be interesting to a student of Manchu.
Yeah, definitely. I think in any case, it will make both a contribution to the general public culture in sort of world historical awareness of Manchus, but also I think I'm really excited to see the potential for just professional researchers. Once you make this available, I think it will really spur a lot of very interesting discussions.
Mm-hmm.
I agree that this text is exciting. It's somehow different from your average biography of Chinese dynastic emperors. So, could you share a couple of your favorite moments in the text?
Yeah. So one of the things that comes first to mind when I want to tell somebody an anecdote from the Manzhou Shilu is one of the assassination attempts, one of the attempts that was made on Nurhaci's life. And this was in 1584.
Really early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was very early. And the political situation of the time was that Nurhaci's father and grandfather had been killed at the siege of Gura.
Mm-hmm.
And that was provoked by Nikan Wailan. And so Nurhaci holds Nikan Wailan personally responsible for the death of his father and grandfather, and he's got a vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to take Nikan Wailan down.
Mm-hmm.
But at this time, he's the grandson of a middle child in a family that rules the upper part of the Suksuhu River Valley. He's not that important. He's got 100 soldiers, but only 30 suits of armor. His vendetta against Nikon Wailan is, it looks kind of doomed initially. And the rest of his family is not with him. They're ready to submit to Nikon Wailan. So his grandfather's, four of his grandfather's five brothers meet secretly in a temple, and they swear to kill Nurhaci and submit to Nikon Wailan. I think there are four assassination attempts in 1583 and 1584, and they've all got this element of excitement and intrigue to them. But one of them is in the summer of 1584. It's a dark, overcast night, and I think I want to call it a dark and stormy night.
Mm-hmm.
And Nurhaci wakes up in the middle of the night and he hears somebody moving around outside. And so he gets up quietly and he gets the children out of harm's way. He hides them somewhere so that they won't be harmed. And then he has his wife pretend to go outside to go to the toilet.
Mm.
And he hides behind her as she goes out. And she goes out and he steps into the shadows of a chimney. And then she goes back inside. And so he's there in the shadows of the chimney when a flash of lightning illuminates the courtyard and he sees the intruder there in front of him. He grabs him, he wrestles him to the ground, and he calls for the servants from the household to come help him. And they come, they subdue him and they tie him up. And there's an old servant named Lal Khan that says, "This is just another assassin. We've got to kill him." And Nurhaci says, he didn't say anything at first. He knows this is an assassin. But he thinks to himself, right now, my conflict with my family is covert. And as long as it's covert, they're going to be sending assassins to try to kill me. I can deal with assassins because they're individual people. If this conflict becomes overt, if I kill this guy and he's somebody's friend, then this conflict could become overt and my 100 soldiers and 30 suits of armor aren't enough to stand up to that. So out loud, he says, "This person is no doubt here to steal some cattle. You should let him go." And Lao Han is like, you're crazy. He's an assassin. I mean, I suppose he could have raised the possibility that somebody who was there to steal cattle wouldn't be in the courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
But Nurhaci is adamant. No, he's only here to steal some cattle. Let him go. And what I like about that anecdote is it reveals some things about Nurhaci's character that are pretty constant throughout his career.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is his willingness to put pragmatism before dignity.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of cases where Nurhaci does something that you wouldn't, and I really love to see if these things are scrubbed from later editions of the text, to walk outside hiding behind his wife while she pretends to go to the toilet, that's not dignified,
mm-hmm.
but it's very strategic. Another thing is the flash of light. Throughout his entire career, Nurhaci mm-hmm. believes that heaven is aiding him.
Mm-hmm.
And the flash of lightning, I think there's no doubt that he takes that as a sign of heaven aiding him, showing him that the intruder is right there.
Mm-hmm. And then this is, I think, also a nice case in which it's so early, right? There was no other record.
Right, yeah.
So the Manmen Laodang starts way later. And,
yeah.
And so this is the only narrative we have.
Right, right. I think he must have been proud of this story and retold it. Otherwise, how would it have ended up in the text and been preserved? Yeah. And it also talks about his strategic approach to things. He, though he believes he has heaven's
There is aid. Some kind of internal, there is a, you can see the interiority of his mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not just he did this and then that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And somehow Manchu was, can convey this.
Yeah.
Very concise kind of actions inside and outside. And I can't wait to see it in English. So before we wrap up, just this, maybe you know that these days in Chinese online discourses, the Manchu suddenly became in vogue again for the reason that they became this placeholder in many people's mind that was this next successor to civilization back in 17th century. And so this is the sort of Ruguanxue discourse. And the reason why people got excited about Manchus again, they are not enemy of China anymore, is because they saw China being kind of perched on the verge of overtaking the U.S. with the, being the hegemonic power of the world. How would you respond to that? Having done so much intimate work with this account, how they accounted their rise?
I think there are definitely parallels, but then there are also clear differences. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look for parallels, the most obvious one to me is Nurhaci's seven grievances, his seven great grievances. You could compare that to the century of humiliation. Nurhaci felt that the Ming had treated him unfairly in the seven major ways and numerous minor ways, and that those grievances were unbearable, and that motivated his making war on the Ming. But in terms of differences, I'm not sure it's clear that Nurhaci envisioned completely dismantling the Ming world order and establishing a new one. I think it's probable that he had that in the back of his mind. But when you look at the way he frames his conflict with the Ming, it's very similar to the way that he frames his conflict with other Jurchen groups. And so that suggests that this type of conflict wasn't something that he thought was related to the Ming as a particular, as taking a particular place in the world order, but was more connected with his ideas of justice and injustice.
There is no sort of manifest destiny in the Manzhou Shilu, is that this is what we are going to do. We're going to replace that.
There is not. There is one thing. This is outside of the Manzhou Shilu. It's in the Yuandong. And it's in. And I was very interested to see that this letter that's in the Yuandong was not included in the Manzhou Shilu. And I don't know necessarily why. But in 1620, Nurhaci wrote a letter to the Khalkha of the Five Encampments, in which he lays out in really interesting detail his argument for his war against the Ming. And at the very beginning of that, he makes this obscure reference. He says that the cryptic words of Liu Bo One, though they are strange, everything he has said has come to pass. Turns out that Liu Bo One wrote a poem called Shaobinga that was taken by many people to predict the fall of the Ming. So that one little bit, maybe that hints that he had some sort of an idea that there was a
cosmic cycle that he's going to write to victory.
Yeah, exactly. But outside of that, I can't think of any place where he dared to put in words that's what he was thinking.
I mean, I think one can see why this is sort of a, even kind of superstition by the Qing standard. Like if you are an elite scholar, like that's something you don't want to put in dynastic history.
Right.
So I think that the Ruguanxue stuff baffles scholars in a way that they just graft different moments together. But I think having a text, complex text, will help people figure out like what was it in the 17th century and right. if it's a good idea to use that to make sense of our own moments, whatever it is. So yeah, that's all really I wanted to ask you today. Is there anything else you want to?
One quick thing. Mm-hmm. I went to Wikipedia and you are right that Norman passed away in 2012. And when I look at my notes, the project is 10 years old, not right. 8 years old.
Okay. So if you are going to complete it in a year or so, it could come out 12 years after it started with this complete zodiac cycle.
Exactly, yeah.
So let's wrap up and just thank you again and to all the members of the group for sharing this work with us.
Thank you. This has been a wonderful conversation.